take some cans. I hope you were behaved and had Gene Coley with you on the beach. So, we're going to do geometric optics fairly quickly, and then we'll move into physical optics and spend a bit of time on that. And I'm sort of trying to move through this stuff to get to quantum mechanics, but so I'm going to spend time on thin lenses and optical instruments mostly, and then there's a, I think, probably a chapter in your book on mirrors and spherical mirrors and such, and I'm actually just going to skip that, and if you want to do it, do it if you ever need it. It's actually, if you've done thin lenses and you're pretty happy with that, you'll find that spherical mirrors are not so different. You just have to get a hold of the conventions. So at some point you may find that you need them, but so I don't mean to belittle them, but they're not really worth our time in this class. Anyway, so we've already talked about some of this, so in particular, I'm just going to remind you of a few things that we did before you had your week to kill brain cells. If you have a lens which is thicker in the middle of the converging lens, typically that is a converging lens if you have an index of refraction that is less on the outside than on the inside, so you do have to stop and think about it. I mean, I think I've given the problem before on some exam, possibly on a workshop, where you have water out here, and you basically have a region of air that is of this shade. And then you'll find these actually will cause rays to diverge because you're spinning things a bit out of the way. So do pay some attention to what's actually going on. But in air, and so the typical meaning for a lens is if it's thicker in the middle, it means you're going to be bent in such a way that that as you look at Snell's law going through the two interfaces, the light rays will be bent down. And pictorially, you can do that by really thinking through three rays. So a ray coming from infinity goes through the focal point, a ray going straight through the lens goes straight, and a ray that goes through the focal point gets bent to infinity. If you're thinner in the middle, if you're in air and you have glass, for example, then the rays will diverge. So rays from infinity will diverge, and if you extrapolate back, they will meet at what we call the focal point. And you can, again, try to think about what's going on by using three rays. The one that goes straight through, the one that goes straight through goes straight. The one that heads to the focal point on the other side gets bent such that it goes to infinity. And the one that comes straight gets bent such that if you extrapolate it back, it goes through the focal point on the other side. And the focal points and thin lenses are they're symmetric from the two sides of the lens. And we can measure the power of the lens. One way to measure is in diopters, where this is 1 over f in focal meter, in meters, focal length in meters. This is typically the way that they are measured for eyeglasses and such, so always bear it in mind. I don't actually know if you work for a lens company, whether they really work in diopters all the time or have some favorite measure that they use. You can talk about the magnification for single lens by the ratio of the height of the object to the height of the image. I'm sorry, ratio of the height of the image to the height of the object. And if you use the conventions for which you'll find in Gene Coley, this is also minus di over d0. Now the minus sign actually, if this is negative, it means it's inverted relative to what you started with. So you talk about upright and inverted images. And this equation is what we use for thin lenses. If the lens is very thick, don't think that it's going to work for you. But for thin lenses, this works. And for single lenses, it's not bad, except you have to keep in mind the conventions. And as I think we talked about last time, Gene Coley has conventions, and you want to get good with them and use them. I don't have a problem if you use conventions that you may learn in your office classes or whatever if they're different, but be consistent. And I do recommend that you state very clearly if you're using a convention set that's different from being polled on any exam or whatever, so that the grader can give you appropriate grading at intermediate stages of the problem. Because obviously if you're getting the wrong answer, the first thing you're going to do is try to figure out where you screwed up. So they're going to look at the signs that you have for things, which basically is conventions, and if they see the wrong signs, they're going to assume you don't know anything about conventions and they'll grade you accordingly, whereas that may not be a mistake, right? You might have one algebraic error at the end, and you're consistent with your conventions, it just happened to not be being called. So just want to tell us. Certainly not married to the convention itself, but you're going to need to be consistent. And then to do multiple lens systems, the trick is the rays, the light that comes through this lens basically will form this image. So if your eye, any object you put over here on this side of the lens will basically see this as its object. Right. So to do multiple lens systems, the real trick is to just remember that whatever the image is for the first lens, that becomes the object for the second lens. So you get really strange things, like I have a second lens right here, and the object for it is actually already on the other side of the lens, and that's where these conventions come in. So you have to have this, for example, to come in with a negative object length instead of a positive object length. Yes?
With magnification, are we saying that the eye of the image is negative and the eye of the response is positive?
I think if you do this, you're really just getting an absolute magnitude.
Okay.
And if you do this, this distance for a converging lens is positive. I think this distance is positive, so you end up... Yeah, I don't know. This seems a little inconsistent in terms of... This one looks loose. For this one, you add the positive sign if the image is upright, and it's negative if it's inverted. And here, I think these are both positive according to this drawing. Now, honestly, it's been a long time since I made this slide, and I may have actually just pulled this out or made it without really thinking and referring to a particular... Just be careful. Yeah, be consistent with these things. And this minus sign is thrown in not because it goes with the DI or the DO, because the object length here by Jean Coley's conventions would be positive. The image length would be positive. You throw the minus sign in here because for a converging lens, you would know that that's inverted. I mean, so... Okay. I could do some examples and stuff. This stuff's not actually hard, it's tedious. So you just sort of need to do some problems and get used to the conventions and drop a few signs and realize, you know, fix what you did. And you'll get the hang of it. It's not typically really very hard. So the trickiest thing is to keep in mind, if you have multiple lenses, that this becomes the object, say, for the second lens, and its image becomes the object for the third lens, etc. And you have to rescale your distances, okay? So, for example, if I have one lens here at x equals 0, and I have another lens at x equals 10, this image is at some distance, and when I'm talking about the object distance for the second lens, I have to take the distance from this to the second lens, not from this to the 0 point you started with. So your distance scales for your distance have to be done relative to the lens that you're discussing when you do the multiple lens system. So a little tedious, but that's the most common kind of thing to screw up, is to not change the scale with each lens that you do. Okay, so you have to do some problems and get used to the conventions. So what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time talking a bit about eyes, because they're near and dear to us, and optical instruments. This being sort of the optical instrument that we're most familiar with, in a sense, or maybe we mostly take it for granted. I think I talked about it a bit last time. You have a lens inside the eye, which the muscle can actually move around, so this allows you to focus within some range of objects. But you also have this curvature, which also bends light. And like I say, with LASIK and things, what they'll do is they'll do things to this corneal layer in order to change the curvature. So in the old, not so distant past, they would cut it here and then reshape it with a laser. And I think now they have other techniques where they actually manage to internally damage it and change the index of refraction in the middle, and they're trying to develop that. But at any rate, the external way to do it is to literally put optical lenses in front. So what happens when you are nearsighted is the light is focused too soon relative to the back of your eye. So you put a diverging lens, which brings the focus to the back of the eye where you have sensitivity. For farsighted eyes, it's the other way around. It's the lens system here is too weak, so you strengthen it by putting a converging lens. I'll talk a bit more about aberrations later. I forgot to have this slide, and I added some today. So you have different kinds of aberrations, and here are just two examples. One, spherical aberrations, where the focal length basically depends on the radius a bit here. So you're a little bit stronger up here than you are in the middle. And so if you're bringing rays that come from a single point here to focus over here in a way that depends on where they pass through the lens, you'll get a blurred out image. Similarly, because dispersion, that is the dependence of the index of refraction on the wavelength, on the frequency, can cause different colors to be bent by different amounts of the lens. You can have different focal points for different colors, and this is called chromatic dispersion. I guess we're getting close to where we ended class last time. Visible light, defined as that which the typical human eye can see, runs from about 400 to 800 nanometers. And we are, if we convolute the eye sensitivity, or if we look at an overlap of the relative sensitivity of the eye to the various colors, our sensitivity peaks in green, which is sort of always something good to know. The different color of different light sources is really driven by the full spectrum of light that you see. And this could be daylight, incandescent lamps. They seem warm, in a sense, and you describe it as being warm because they're sort of reddish. Things that are cool tend to be more bluish. And if you go to buy fluorescent lighting, sort of like what you have up here, what you'll find is you can actually buy fluorescent lights with different so-called temperatures. And so if you go to the cool temperatures, they'll be very bluish. If you go to the warm temperatures, they'll seem very much less blue. But what you'll find is when you have different types of lamps, how it strikes you, you can see it very different. And when you do digital photography, yeah. Sorry.
For color temperature, I believe that it's defined like 9300K, 10,000K, for different kinds of lamps and photography monitors. Do you know how that convention comes about?
Yeah, we're going to actually derive it before too long. It comes about from, if you take an object, if you're able to put an object in a situation where there's no reflected light, and you look at the light that comes off it, it turns out that everything glows. It's called blackbody radiation. And there's a very characteristic spectrum of glowing light that comes off of each object. And it turns out that the frequency of that, the peak of that spectrum, depends on the temperature of the object. And so that's really where it comes from. So in fact, you can get a very particular black body spectrum And when you change the temperature of something, you see that it will swing. And when you change the temperature, you see it changes in frequency. So for example, if you turn on an element on the stove, as it starts to warm up, you'll see it's sort of a very dark red. And as it gets hotter and hotter, you'll see that that red becomes brighter and brighter. And then you talk about things that are white hot, and if they're really, really super hot, blue hot. So what's happening is the thing is getting hotter and hotter, and the whole, the black body spectrum of the emitted light from this thing that's glowing literally shifts from red to blue as you're watching it.
So when we talk about a monitor that has a temperature of 8500 Kelvin, that can be the same as a black body emitter that is at that temperature?
Probably. I mean, maybe they have some other crazy arbitrary scale than these, but my guess is that it would mean that the peak of the distribution for the light that's coming off is roughly where the peak would be for an 8500 degree black body. That would be my guess. But I'd have to actually stop and think what that frequency is. So that makes sense. But you find that this is very common. We talk about the temperature of the cosmic microwave background that's coming from the early stage of the universe at like 4 degrees Kelvin or whatever. It's the same sort of thing. It's a black body in microwaves that peaks at a temperature that corresponds to the frequency a black body at 4 degrees would have. I mean, but we're going to talk a lot about it because if you believe that you understand light and you believe you understand matter, then one of the simplest things that you can try to describe is to take an object, put it in a dark room, and try to describe the frequency of the light that is emitted by it as you change its temperature. That's called light body radiation. And it turns out that you cannot do that with classical Maxwell stuff. So it's one of the major things that led to the development of quantum mechanics, which is where we're going to spend half a day talking about it. So eyes are cool. I mean, you're sort of used to looking at pictures of the human eye, I think, but there are lots of really cool eyes out there if you stop and look at them. So in one type, you have the sensitive elements really pretty close to the surface. In others, you image on the sensitive elements in back, which this is a little bit more like a human eye. So this is what we were just looking at. But sometimes instead of having a fairly complicated place for the light to come in, it can be as simple as just a hole, so like a pinhole camera. Or you can have a compound eye where literally the each of these points acts as a pixel. In this case, you've got the pixels way back here, and you form an image across it. In this case, you literally have an individual lens for each optical element that you've got. And so you'll see examples of all these out in the world. So this is an example of the compound eye. So basically each of these dots represents a lens that's effectively focusing the light down, pulling the light into an instrument that it's measuring.
Is that more effective?
Well, more effective. It works, but you get here's an example of what a bee would see. So part of what you mean by effectiveness is, does it serve the purpose for what you want? And the world of a bee or the world of a fly is very different from the world of a human or a hawk. So maybe on the next slide. Yeah. So one of the things you see, if you look at the resolution that you expect to have for different eyes versus the body height, or the height at which you basically need to be in order to get to your prey. This is body height, and this is the resolution that the eye has. Okay, so what it says is if you're really short, tiny, the resolution is actually pretty sorry. This is resolution in degrees, so you can think of it as the ability to distinguish two point sources of light. in terms of degrees, for example, or if you are trying to see if you can actually image something because you want to decide whether it's something you want to eat. So very short things have pretty sorry eyesight, whereas things like, let's see, okay, so for example, this is 15. 15 is a house fly, okay? Or 17, a jumping spider. So, okay, but 3, 4, 2, 1. 1 is man, 2 is a peregrine falcon. I don't know what this actually means, but 3 is a hen, 6 is a finch of some sort. So you can see that things that by necessity are going to be far away from their prey have to have very good eyesight and pretty good. So this is just an example of evolution at work, which I think is really cool. There's other examples. Oops. Right? If you're a beast that has to eat in the dark, you need big openings so you let in a lot of light. This is one of the coolest ones. There's a minnow which has an eye that's set up so that you can put it. The minnow sits at water with the water level right at about here so you can see it. Okay? And the lens is set up so that you get proper focusing up here onto this part, and proper focusing down here where the index of refraction is quite different, right? So you need different curvature here to make it work. But you get an image up here. So this beast can actually see in the water and the air simultaneously well. Is that cool? I think that's cool. So if you went snorkeling last week, you know that this would be completely cool. You could do this. Okay, so magnifying glasses are good for more than just burning ants, but to get a sense of what they are, the reason they're so important is you actually use magnifying glasses in optical instruments to give you sort of the final image that you see. So they turn out to be fairly important within many optical instruments. But the basic idea is you take a converging lens, and if you put an object near the focal length, remember, if something is at the focal length, then rays that come out are bent basically to come out parallel. So if you're fairly close to the focal length here, the rays that come out are close to parallel, and you effectively will create an image that, if you're at the focal length, this image is said to be at infinity. Okay, it's as if the rays are coming from infinity. And so this image looks just like this, but it's magnified. And we... this is what you see if you're unaided. And this is a number that you just want to keep in mind, and you'll run across many different optics problems where you have to use it. And it may not be true for you, but there's a thing called the near point. So if you take your finger and you bring it close, if you have one eye closed and you bring it in, it becomes the point where it starts to go out of focus for you. Okay? Similarly, if you're nearsighted, you would also have an important thing would be called your far point, which is how far away can it go before you can no longer see it. So if you've never done your near point, you should do it, even if you think you look stupid doing it. So you bring it close, and your eye, your lens in your eye will change its shape to the point where it can no longer change its shape, and you'll lose focus if you go any closer. So that distance is called the near point. And I believe that distance is actually defined to be from the very front of the eye here. And a rule that you need to know, because it's sort of by definition, and it has to come into lots of things, such as the power of eyeglasses and stuff like that when you're doing problems, this is 25 centimeters for a normal eye, whatever the healthy normal eye is. It's just the number you have to keep. So if we were able to somehow average everyone's eyes for healthy eyes that didn't need glasses, you would find that this distance is about 25 centimeters. Okay. If you put this object at the focal length, you basically have the same angle, but now your lens isn't having to do any extra work in order to cause the rays to converge in order to focus on it, for example. So, and if you have the object at focal point, we say that the image is infinity, and all we really mean by that is that your lens doesn't have to do much. But also, calculationally, your image is infinity, so that distance becomes infinite. So that term goes to zero, and lens goes. So again, I think you really do want to do some problems that involve magnifying glasses and glasses. I find that every time I do them, I have to sort of get used to it again, and it's very easy to start with, and you have to get the conventions right to get the problems right. So just go about it carefully. So in terms of optical instruments, this would be an example of our first compound lens system. So the idea is that light is collected from some distant object. In particular, for a telescope, the object is thought to be very, very far away. So that means that rays are coming in straight, coming in from infinity, which means that they are focused right at the focal point. So this would be FO, would be the focal point of the objective. So that at that distance, these rays are focused. Okay. And then what you want to do is to remember that now it is as if this is the object of whatever lens you put behind it. And so we put a magnifying glass, which we call an eyepiece, effectively, here, such that this objective image distance position lands very close to the focal position of this eyepiece. So this image position becomes the object for this lens. And just like in the picture we had on the last slide, this thing now gets magnified. So that when you now look at this, you see the image being much larger than the image that comes from this particular lens. You okay with that? So it's just a particular form of a two-lens system. Theoretically, there's nothing special about it. These are telescopes that are simply lens systems like this are known as refractive telescopes. Okay, and they actually turn out not to be particularly common in usage because in astronomy, what you'd like to do is collect a lot of light because you have very, very dim objects. So you want something as large as possible to collect as much light as possible and bring it to an image. And it turns out that it's very expensive to make very large objective lenses. So what's typically done is you have a mirror, which we're not going to really spend time covering, but you'll have a spherical mirror, or a mirror, probably not spherical because it's very big, but the idea of the mirror is that the light is collected and it then is focused, because depending on the curvature of this, you can focus light as if it were a converging lens. And then you do the same trick with the eyepiece. And so there are different types of configurations of mirrors that you can use for telescopes. This, I think, is typically a Newtonian. It's now called a reflecting telescope. And this, I believe, is usually called a Schmidt-Cassegrain or something like that. These types of optical systems, you're not going to need to know how to calculate, although it's not particularly any harder than the kind of stuff that you're going to be doing. This system, I want you to be able to calculate and understand optically. And then if you ever really do need to do something with a reflecting telescope, go pay attention to the spherical mirror chapter, and then you know you can figure it out from that. Telescopes are cool, and we've been in the midst of, I think, a real revolution in terms of telescopes in the last 20 years or so. Years ago, we were limited by the size of basically a single piece of glass that you could make and then curve to the point where, in order for the image to be really clear, you have to have the curvature to be some small fraction of the wavelength of the light that you're planning to image. And you could have a big piece of glass and cool it down, but then to be able to do that kind of precise polishing and not have the glass actually deform under its own weight, especially when you're putting it in different orientations, is a really hard thing to do. So it turned out for years, in terms of the single pieces of glass, people certainly got to where they could make big ones. They would make honeycomb glass and everything so that they were a lot lighter than normal. There's a real industry involved. But the place where things have really been gone in the recent years has been to actually make a single telescope mirror out of lots of individual mirrors, and literally get images from all these various pieces, and then using techniques to be able to combine the light coming from each of these various pieces. So there's been a lot of research in this, and so nowadays the really large telescopes are starting to be made of lots of smaller pieces. So here, for example, are two of the big multiple mirror telescopes called Keck Observatory in Hawaii. And so you literally are taking these two things and you're looking at the same object and collecting and combining the light accordingly. The one you probably hear lots about is the Hubble. So if you want to do astronomy, one of the big problems is that it's not just collecting the light, so you can make a bigger and bigger mirror, and one of the issues is gravity in that case. But the bigger issue is that you have an atmosphere to Earth, so as the light is coming in, the light doesn't go in a straight line because it has to go through different levels of the atmosphere, and different types of gas have different indices of refraction, and they're moving, and temperatures are changing constantly throughout the thing, which means as the light comes in, it will quite literally get dim a bit, right? So you don't have a direct piece of vision. And what makes it even worse is because the atmosphere is so dynamic and continuous, you'll have this piece of light and this piece of light have slightly different bending. And so these atmospheric distortions have limited in the past our ability to make really precise, high-resolution pictures from Earth-based telescopes, regardless of how large you would make the mirror. So the one way around that is to put the telescope up above the atmosphere. Now, of course, astronomers are not, we sort of think of astronomy. If you haven't thought much about astronomy, what you think of are the pretty pictures, and so that means visible light is sort of what you think. But it turns out that astronomy explores all the different regions of the electromagnetic spectrum. Different physical processes happen that produce gamma rays, that produce X-rays, that produce UV light, infrared light, etc. So in fact, astronomy has made great strides by literally having telescopes that are sensitive in all these different regions of the spectrum. So there are some regions of the spectrum where you not only get atmospheric distortions of light, but basically the light is completely absorbed by the atmosphere. So in those instances, it's not just the distortion. You actually have to have the telescope up above the atmosphere in order to see it at all. Anyway, the Hubble Space Telescope was launched in 1990. If you don't know the story, you should look it up on Wikipedia and learn the story. It was really horrific. I mean, when I was a kid, when I was in college or younger, we were really looking forward to the launching of this space telescope. They talked about it for years. It took a long time to produce this stupid thing, okay? And it justified in their eyes the whole shuttle thing. It was like it was going to be this great thing where you could send up space shuttles and put this thing in orbit and then maybe service it now and then. And so it was a big deal. They had the very best people on. They put the thing up there, and it turns out that they had screwed up in polishing the mirror. And it actually didn't image things very well. And they needed to put in a corrective optical element. So they then, 3 years later, sent up a spacecraft. And I mean, it's one of the great, great things that NASA did, actually. They were able to send up astronauts who were able to go in and perform surgery on the Hubble and put in a corrective optical element. And so the story ended very well, and we have all this fabulous images from the Hubble Space Telescope that came out. You hear a lot about Hubble, but there are other things. There's the Spitzer Space Telescope. There's the Herschel. There's a number of different observatories. Most of them are sensitive in different regions of the electromagnetic spectrum. And that's really fabulous because you really learn a lot of different things. So, for example, if you're in the infrared, one of the things you get, that basically you have things that are glowing, but they're not so hot. You have the black body radiation, basically. So at the temperatures of gas clouds that are beginning to form stars, you don't see the light from the internal star, or the star having the star fusion reactions yet. It's obscured by all this dust, but hot things are happening here, so it's sort of hot dust, and what happens is it glows in the infrared. So if you're studying stellar formation, planetary formation, you want to study infrared telescope. You want to study infrared astronomy. If you want to study the most active processes going on, very energetic processes in the centers of galaxies, you want to look at ultraviolet and X-rays and things like that. We had the project manager for the next big telescope that basically is effectively the successor to Hubble, which is called the James Webb Space Telescope, which is supposed to be launched in 2018. And here's sort of a picture of it. Whereas the Hubble mirror, single mirror... Oops. What am I doing? There we go. Has 2.4 meters. The James Webb will have a 6.5 primary mirror. So what you see here actually is the sun. You have to orbit. I mean, it has to orbit around something. You can't just send it off in space because you want to get the telemetry. So this is actually sent fairly far out, and the sun is in this direction, and these are literally solar shields to keep this thing in the shade and keep it nice and cool. And sometimes you have to do that because if you're sensitive to heat as the spectra that you're trying to measure, then you have to keep things at a very cold temperature. So here is sort of as a function of wavelength versus effectively the brightness of the object that you can see. This gives you a sense of some of the sensitivity, also the wavelength regions. So at longer wavelengths, you have the Herschel. Spitzer is infrared, and then the Hubble is visible, and the James Webb sort of covers the middle of this. But you see, sort of, this is a log scale, so this is the optical sensitivity of the James Webb. So I think we're going to see some pretty fabulous stuff coming out of that eventually. Somebody asked a question a while ago. I knew there was something that I ditched on. If you've done digital photography, we were talking a little while ago about how things look different in different lights, in different kinds of light. If you've done much digital photography, a lot of stuff is done for you in the sense that the picture gets recorded electronically, so you have this data, and then the question is, what do you do with it? If you really get into digital photography, one of the things you can do is to use some digital editing software. When you look at it, one of the things you can do is to literally adjust for the lighting of the light source that you use. And so, as we saw, the spectrum of the light coming from incandescent light, sunlight, and the flash, these all give you different spectra of light, which means the objects all look different to you, depending on what the light is. And you can go into this digital editing software and literally change and account for the spectrum of the light that's coming in. So you can have it adjusted for flash or for this type of lighting or whatever and get much better colors out of it. So if you ever have a chance, you should actually have it on my laptop. Maybe if I think about it next time, I'll come up with a good example and show you how the picture changes depending on what you do with the input spectrum of light. But the software allows you to correct for it, so it actually turns out to be very powerful. Things. So if you ever really get into digital photography, what you want to do is, see, the problem is the little snapshot cameras, they do all this stuff for you, and they're very good, and they know what they're doing, so they turn out okay, but you lose all the flexibility when it does everything for you. Whereas if you have a camera that basically saves the original data that you can download into a program, you can then actually futz with a lot of the stuff with digital cameras. So I'll show you. You can take a picture that's pretty good and really make it phenomenal by pretty small changes in things like the spectrum of the light that's incident on the object. And you can do it unfairly, of course. You can doctor pictures this way, but you can also really make it much more true to life in a way that the kinds of stuff that, because they have to make choices, right? They have to decide, okay, what are you likely to be taking pictures of, and what kind of light spectrum do we assume, and things like that. If they have the flash on or not, that they can know, but they can't know whether you took the picture in here or outside. So the input light is very different in both cases. Any rate, so if you do look at a single lens reflex camera, this gives you an idea of what the optics looks like. The light comes in, you have a series of lenses, then it's reflected by a mirror up. There's a prism here, so the light comes out. This happens to basically make the image upright for you. And you're looking through here, so it's a real-time image. And then to take the picture, this mirror flips up out of the way, basically, and you have a sensor back here, which is what now senses the light. So they're sort of heavy beasts, but they're also very powerful. And if you learn much about photography, what you'll find is that there are lots of strange numbers on the lenses and everything. And if you get a real camera like this, then you'll find that they're all over the place. If you have just a snap shooter, again, they're in there, but you don't really have to think about them typically. But you guys are going to have to learn to think about them a little bit for this class. Typically, you talk about things that are time of exposure. Right, you get more light if you have the shutter, which is what's stopping the light from coming in. If you have the shutter open longer, you get more light coming in. But at the same time, if you're now taking a picture of something that's moving, that'll blur it out. So if you want to take a picture of something that's moving, you want the time of the exposure to be at least as small as possible. If that's true, though, then if it's really fast, you get no light. So the only way to get more light is to open up the opening that's used for imaging onto the film or the sensor. So you have sort of three or four different variables. One is the time of exposure. The other is the opening of this film. Those are the main two. And another thing that comes into play is sort of the angle at which the light comes through this hole. And that will determine the depth of the field of focus in the picture. So I'll try to make some of this make sense of it to you. So if you have this picture, your speed is limited by on the low end by the fact that your hand will move or something. The wind will blow, whatever. So if you want to take a picture of something with a long exposure, you need a really stable platform, and you have to be taking a picture of something that's not moving. Okay? On the high end, then you want to make the picture as fast as possible, but now your limit is simply literally the amount of light that you get. If it's too fast, you have no light coming through the lens, so you can't actually image anything. So you have sort of limitations for anything that you're trying to take a picture of in terms of practically what you can do. And so how do you get around some of that? Well, if you go to the high end, then what you want to do is to open up this hole and let in more light. But what that will do, as I'll show you, gives you a much narrower depth of field. So what that means is that if you're trying to focus on something, the depth of field is the region at which you're looking where things are in focus. You have a narrow depth of field, you might have a picture of a pretty flower, and everything else is all blurred out in front and behind. Whereas if you have a wide field of depth of field, then you would see the flower and some trees behind it and stuff in front of it. So you have a focus over a large region. And you sometimes need to adjust that for artistic reasons, but also sometimes if you've ever tried to take pictures with a very narrow field of focus, it's really hard. I mean, if you're taking pictures of somebody at a soccer game and you have a really narrow field of focus, for example, you may find that everything is out of focus because you focused on the ball instead of this person's head, which is 2 feet in front of it or something. So it's really hard to get some of this. So just to give you a sense, a lot of this is characterized by something which is called the f-stop, which is defined as the focal length of the lens divided by this diameter of this opening in a strange sort of way. So how that works.
Let's look.
So this f-stop, or sometimes called the f-ratio, so these are the strange numbers that you would find on the lens of the camera. And if you go to where the bottom number, that is the diameter, gets bigger, then you're actually going to where you have a smaller opening. So the way to think about this is, for example, if I have a lens that has a 10 millimeter focal length, and I have an aperture of 5 meters, and we call that an F2 lens. If you take that same lens, but now make this aperture, which is that opening, you put it much smaller because you have a much brighter source, then you get an F5.6. So the thing is, if you have a large, for a given lens, you have a maximum aperture, and if it's very large, then you have what's called a fast lens because you can let in a lot of light. So it allows you to take pictures in low light things, allows you to take pictures very fast. And take pictures very fast, it gives you a very narrow field of focus. So artistically, it's a really nice way to be able to do it. But the thing is, if you have a large opening, you're prone to have things like spherical aberrations. And so it's a much harder lens to produce and produce well. And so the lenses get very, very expensive. So if you ever care about doing photography, you're going to find that lenses can be very wild in terms of their cost. So each of these f-stops effectively is a factor of 2 in light intensity. Okay, and remember that the amount of light is going to go as the time times the area, and the area goes as the diameter squared. So each of these will differ in radius by a diameter by about a factor of 1.4 because it's scaling as the diameter squared.
So how some of this comes into play.
Here's your lens, and your aperture is dictated by basically the opening through which you're letting this light pass. If you have the focal length is long and or the opening is small, okay, then you'll have this kind of situation where as the light rays come together, you have a region where the light rays are fairly close together, which is fairly large longitudinally. This would give you a very deep field of focus. That is, you would everything in the picture would seem to be very much in focus. If you have a very small opening or a very short focal length, then the rays are coming at sharp angles, and you have a region where they're very close together, which is very, very small. And so this is very narrow, and it means that you only have a focus if your sensor is right within this region. So you have a very narrow region where you can see anything. So practically what that means is, here's a picture out my window, and in this case, I have a small opening but a large focal length, and what it gives me is a very slow exposure time because I have a small opening. I have to basically take the picture of a fairly large amount of time. So there's a little bit of blurring from hand motion, but what you should notice is these columns back on the other side of Lattimore are all in focus, as well as the squirrel, although the hand has moved a little bit. If I now crank the exposure time down, and I have to open the hole up in the lens in order to let in more light, because I'm taking it over a fast time, look at what happens. I'm well focused here, but I'm totally blurred out back here. Right, so all these photographic effects, you know, literally come down to what's going on.
You okay? We're not doing that much with cameras, but
I think it's probably good for you to have some sense of what those things are. You can also have F ratios with optical instruments, whether it's like microscopes and telescopes. So this is an example of the kind of stuff that you end up having to think about with optical instruments. You can have aberrations in these things that can affect the images. We've already talked about a couple. We have dispersion. Here's a beautiful picture of dispersion in action where we have white light coming in, and then you see the different colors are bent differently, red bent less than the blue. And this will take a picture and literally give you a separation in terms of the focal position based on the different colors. And that will screw your image up. And you can correct for it. You can put in lenses of different shapes and different optical dispersions. And you can see that, for example, here's a converging lens, and you have dispersion happening, but you can then put in a diverging lens with slightly different dispersion and a slightly converging lens, etc., so that in the end you can now use the lens system to take out the chromatic aberration. So that's why when you look at real optical instruments, you seldom see just the one lens. I mean, then you often will see multiple lenses in place, because what they're trying to do is to get rid of these aberrations. We've seen spherical aberrations, again, where a typical thin lens, you'll have the focal length will actually vary depending on what your radius is a little bit. And you can play games by changing the shape of the lens a little bit to adjust and take that out. If you have a spherical aberration, this is the kind of stuff you see in the picture. Astigmatism is near and dear to many of us who have needed glasses. And this is, if you have astigmatism, what it means is that literally the focal length of your eye is different in one dimension than it is in another, the orthogonal dimension, is the way to think about it. So you have an astigmatism in a lens. If the focal length here, so if we're taking things along this axis and we look at how that light is focused, it's sort of focused over here. And if we look at it this way, it's focused a little different. So that sort of gives you an angular dependence to your focal length that is difficult. And again, in the old days when people would do contact lenses, this was hard, because the way you fix astigmatism is you have a lens, and you have the strength of the lens depends on the direction, which is hard to do if you put a contact lens in which can rotate. So they literally had to figure out ways to effectively get the orientation of the contact lens to be fixed so that they could give some directionality to the strength. It's easy to fix with glasses, but I remember the day when they used to say, oh, you can't have contacts because I can't wear contacts because I have astigmatism. That was because they hadn't solved that problem. Nowadays, so then they got to where you could do it with hard lenses, which were literally would. So I don't know. Do they have it fixed now if you have contacts, soft lenses, you can take out astigmatism? How do they do that? Asymmetrically, so it orients or something?
Yes, it orients.
Yeah, because they need to have the orientation for you to fix the signature. Anyway, so it's a tough optical problem. But when I had LASIK, one of the reasons, so you can have higher and higher order. I mean, this is a two-axis thing, but you can imagine having something that's better described by six axes or whatever. So effectively, you do different multipoles, angular multipole description of the focusing, because this is sort of simpleton and discrete, but it's not that way, right? It's a continuous thing, and so. When you do LASIK or whatever, if they really know what the distortions are, they can correct it out in a continuous way. So it's sort of cool. Any thoughts about any of this? You guys okay? All right. So I was thinking at some point we might do spherical mirrors, but nah. I have no interest in doing that. You can read the book. So there's some pretty pictures I'll throw in the notes. But you get something that looks very familiar, right? In this case, you've got the light coming in, and basically you have the law of reflection at the surface, but the surface is curved. So you form images, and again, you have rules about how the rays can be drawn, and it's pretty simple. You have to have a convention about distances, object distances and image distances, and what's a positive and negative focal length. Maybe you've seen it in a geometric optics course. It is probably worth paging through the chapter in Gene Coley if you've never seen it. I'm not going to test you on it, but you do see it enough that it's probably worth doing. But you end up with an equation that's very similar, but now the conventions are different, the magnification. So it is so similar to thin lenses, I don't actually think that there's any gain to me spending time on it in this class. And you can certainly go off and learn what you need. Anybody got a problem with that? No? Yes? Okay, good. Okay, so the next step is that I wanted to get into is what's more known as physical optics instead of geometrical optics. And in geometrical optics, generally speaking, we think of light as rays, but light ain't just rays. And we're going to have to now face that. And one of the fundamental principles that we use in thinking our way through physical optics is called the Huygens-Fresnel principle, and I probably say that a little bit wrong, but the guy's Dutch. So, how many of you have had the cheese that's spelled yeah? And how do you say it? Yeah. You want to know how you really say it? How? Yeah, I have a Dutch friend who corrected me on this the other day. So I had great fun with that after successive glasses of wine and started quoting my German professor. This is Dutch. My German professor used to say that German isn't being spoken correctly, they're not spitting it. So I said, based on that, it should probably be Maybe you had to be there. At any rate, I'm sure that that was very small potatoes compared to the kind of trouble some of you were probably getting into last week. So anyway, that's Hauge. So this is actually H-U-Y-G-E-N-S. I think the safest thing is to say Huygens, okay? But if you listen to someone who knows how to pronounce it, it's sort of an unpronounceable thing, and maybe someone here can do this, like Huygens, or there's some sort of weird that they do. So, I don't know. Ask Frank Wolf to pronounce it for you. I'm sure he'll do it just fine and then laugh at you when you can't repeat it. Anyway, this guy Huygens, so Huygens with a little spit in the middle, but how I can do it. Came up with something that you can prove from basic wave theory, and I'm not going to bother with it, not because it's not important, but I have other things I'd rather do. But we're basically, for a given wavefront, at any given moment, you can think of every point in the wavefront as being a new source of waves of the same frequency. Okay, a circular spherical wavefront. And this is very important to think of it this way when you're trying to understand diffraction in particular. So pictorially, if you can imagine having a very wide opening here, and let's imagine we have a plane wave coming in, what Huygens' principle tells us is that at each point, if we imagine the light passing through this wave, this hole, you can imagine at each of these various points, it acts as a spherical source of waves. And waves interfere, right? Waves add together. It's the superposition of the waves that you end up being sensitive to. So it turns out each of these points at some continuum are acting as a spherical wavefront. Then here they sort of all interfere to give you effectively the plane wave coming straight through. But if you look at the edges over here, you've got spherical wave headed out this way without a wave coming back the other way to interfere and effectively give you only the component that's moving out this direction. So you end up with some curvature on the end, okay? And as you narrow this opening down, that effect becomes a bit more pronounced. And this turns out to be very important to keep in mind mentally when we're talking about diffraction and interference of light coming through various objects. Okay, so what I want to do now is to start talking about wavefronts. And I'm going to do something that at least some of you, I'm pretty sure, have probably seen it in interference and diffraction classes in optics. Others may not have. I'm going to do it my way, which some of you may find helpful or not. Okay? I don't know. But we do need to learn to talk about general wavefronts. And this will be the language that we're also going to use for many of our quantum mechanics problems. So I sort of want to go through it fairly carefully. So I want to talk about the complex representation of waves. And by complex, I don't mean painfully difficult, hopefully. I mean complex as in using complex numbers, right? So if you recall, a complex number, which I'll call z, is equal to some real number I, or some plus, sorry, x plus iy, where remember that I is equal to the square root of minus 1. Okay? And so we talk about things in the complex plane where we have the so-called imaginary axis and the real axis, where you go out some distance x on the real axis, some distance y on the imaginary axis, and now this point in the imaginary plane is x plus iy. And this distance would be r, which is
the magnitude of Z. So you take the magnitude of the imaginary part and the magnitude of the real part, and you add them together vectorially to get R. And we have an angle theta here. So if that's our angle theta, and X and Y are both real, then Z, which is equal to X plus IY, is equal to R times cosine of theta plus R times I times sine theta. You okay with that? I'm sort of assuming you are, so I'm going to go fairly fast, but... Now, I'm going to make use of something which most of you have probably seen, which says that e to the I theta is equal to cosine of theta plus I sine theta. And this is known as the Euler formula. So in terms of this, Z is equal to R times e to the I phi, okay? And this is known as the phase angle of Z. And this R is known as the magnitude of Z. Z star, I'm going to define as the complex conjugate. Of Z, and this is where you replace I with minus I. And the reason that you do that is because you find that it allows you to calculate Z very nicely, the magnitude of Z. So Z star is going to be equal to R e to the minus I theta, or x minus iy, or r times cosine theta minus I sine theta by definition. You okay with that? I'm putting you to sleep, I hope. But if not, then slow it down. And if you have questions, I want you to come and talk to me. But this turns out to be pretty important stuff. So one of the reasons that we do exponentials instead of dealing with the sine and cosine, and you should already have a sense of probably where I'm going. We define waves in terms of sines and cosines. So I can use this stuff to redefine the waves instead of sines and cosines as exponentials. And when you've got exponentials, it turns out that lots of things are very easy. This little I is sort of annoying, okay? But you can define... things, and you can take something and look at it as e to the I whatever, and then just specify at the end that you take the real part, and that just pulls out the cosine or the sine if you take the imaginary part. So there's a, in a sense, it's a very easy way to do a lot of manipulations, and then if you really needed to get down to something we're calculating at the end, you say, but I take the real part, and you can get down to the sines and cosines or whatever. But often you don't really actually need to do that. Usually. So, just in terms of addition and subtraction and the algebraic rules, you know, z1 plus or minus z2 is equal to x1 plus or minus x2, so that's the real part, plus I times y1 plus y2. So you, when you add the complex numbers, you're adding together the real and imaginary parts. If you do multiplication or division, z1 times z2 is multiplication. This is easy because they're exponentials, so that would be r1 times r2 e to the I phi 1 plus phi 2. So
When you multiply exponentials, you just add the exponents. When you divide exponentials, you subtract the exponents. So that part's pretty easy. And then an important aspect of it is how to get at z. And with these complex numbers, you get the magnitude of the number by taking the number and multiplying it by its complex conjugate, and then take the square root. And so remember, this will give you x squared plus y squared. Remember, those are real numbers. And x squared plus y squared gives you, the square root of that gives you this length squared. So, not the square root. The square root of x squared plus y squared gives you this length, which is what you're after. So what I find is that, there's a reason why I'm going through here, this, because when I was sitting where you were sitting, people just started using complex exponentials and talking about waves. And I was like, cosine kx minus omega t, you get the I what? It just made no sense to me. Okay, and it's really not so bad, and you just want to be very comfortable with it. So, z is equal to the real part of z plus I times the imaginary part of z, right? So the real part of z is equal to 1/2 z plus z star, right? X plus iy plus x minus iy. The I pieces cancel and you end up with 2x divided by 2 gives you x, which is the real part of the original thing. Similarly, the imaginary part of z is equal to 1 over 2 times I z minus z star. Okay? Where the sines and cosines come in, you've actually already seen a connection to the real part of z is equal to r times the cosine of theta, and the imaginary part of z is equal to r times the sine of theta. And you can either use these expressions and go up and rewrite z in terms of the sines and cosines, and that'll work. Or you can go up and look at this picture and see that the real part here is going to be r times the cosine of theta, and this distance is going to be r times the sine of theta. Okay, so this would be, this x would be the real part of z, and the y is going to be the imaginary part of z. Okay? So all of that is really the preliminary to get to where I wanted to get, which is if we have some wave, some psi of xt, how you're used to saying it, describing it, is as an amplitude times the cosine of kx minus omega t. And this we can rewrite as the real part of a e to the I kx minus omega t.
Okay? You all right with that? Now, because you're all right with that, and because anybody else would be all right with that, we have to disguise it a little bit. And the way we disguise it is we simply write it like this. And then we don't tell anybody about that real part. And then that sort of continues. Then it comes nicely continues. You all right with that? Okay. I better stop there.
We'll see you Wednesday.